Chapter 135. Martha, we were now down in Westminster. We had turned back to follow her, having encountered her coming towards us, and Westminster Abbey was the point at which she passed from the lights and noise of the leading streets. She proceeded so quickly, when she got free of the two currents of passengers setting towards and from the bridge, that, between this and the advance she had of us when she struck off, we were in the narrow waterside street by Millbank, before we came up with her. At that moment she crossed the road, as if to avoid the footsteps that she heard so close behind, and, without looking back, passed on even more rapidly. A glimpse of the river through a dull gateway, where some wagons were housed for the night, seemed to arrest my feet. I touched my companion without speaking, and we both forbore to cross after her, and both followed on that opposite side of the way, keeping as quietly as we could in the shadow of the houses, but keeping very near her. There was, and as when I write, at the end of that low-lying street, a dilapidated little wooden building, probably an obsolete old ferry house. Its position is just at that point where the street ceases, and the road begins to lie between a row of houses and the river. As soon as she came here, and saw the water, she stopped as if she had come to her destination, and presently went slowly along by the brink of the river, looking intently at it. All the way here, I had supposed that she was going to some house. Indeed, I had vaguely entertained the hope that the house might be in some way associated with the lost girl. But that one dark glimpse of the river, through the gateway, had instinctively prepared me for her going no farther. The neighborhood was a dreary one at that time, as oppressive, sad, and solitary by night as any about London. There were neither wharves nor houses on the melancholy waste of road near the great blank prison. A sluggish ditch deposited its mud at the prison walls. Coarse grass and rank weeds straggled over all the marshy land in the vicinity. In one part, carcasses of houses, inauspiciously begun and never finished, rotted away. In another, the ground was cumbered with rusty iron monsters of steam boilers, wheels, cranks, pipes, furnaces, paddles, anchors, diving bells, windmill sails, and I know not what strange objects, accumulated by some speculator, and groveling in the dust, underneath which having sunk into the soil of their own weight in wet weather they had the appearance of vainly trying to hide themselves. The clash and glare of sundry fiery works upon the riverside arose by night to disturb everything except the heavy and unbroken smoke that poured out of their chimneys. Slimy gaps and causeways, winding among old wooden piles, with a sickly substance clinging to the latter, like green hair, and the racks of last year's handbills offering rewards for drowned men fluttering above high water mark, led down through the ooze and slush to the ebb tide. There was a story that one of the pits dug for the dead in the time of the Great Plague was hereabout, and a blighting influence seemed to have proceeded from it over the whole place. Or else it looked as if it had gradually decomposed into that nightmare condition, out of the overflowings of the polluted stream. As if she were a part of the refuse it had cast out, and left to corruption and decay, the girl we had followed strayed down to the river's brink, and stood in the midst of this night picture, lonely and still, looking at the water. There were some boats and barges astrand in the mud, and these enabled us to come within a few yards of her without being seen. I then signed to Mr. Peggotty to remain where he was, and emerged from their shade to speak to her. I did not approach her solitary figure without trembling, for this gloomy end to her determined walk, and the way in which she stood, almost within the cavernous shadow of the iron bridge, looking at the lights crookedly reflected in the strong tide, inspired a dread within me. I think she was talking to herself. I am sure, although absorbed in gazing at the water, that her shawl was off her shoulders, and that she was muffling her hands in it, in an unsettled and bewildered way, more like the action of a sleepwalker than a waking person. I know, and never can forget, that there was that in her wild manner which gave me no assurance but that she would sink before my eyes, until I had her arm within my grasp. At the same moment I said, "Martha!" She uttered a terrified scream, and struggled with me with such strength, that I doubt if I could have held her alone. But a stronger hand than mine was laid upon her, and when she raised her frightened eyes and saw whose it was, she made but one more effort, and dropped down between us. We carried her away from the water to where there were some dry stones, and there laid her down, crying and moaning. In a little while she sat among the stones, holding her wretched head with both her hands. "Oh, the river!" she cried passionately. "Oh, the river!" "Hush, hush!" said one. "Calm yourself!" But she still repeated the same words, continually exclaiming, "Oh, the river!" Over and over again. "I know it's like me!" she exclaimed. "I know that I belong to it. I know that it's the natural company of such as I am. It comes from country places, where there was once no harm in it, and it creeps through the dismal streets, defiled and miserable, and it goes away, like my life, to a great sea that is always troubled, and I feel that I must go with it." I have never known what despair was, except in the tone of those words. "I can't keep away from it. I can't forget it. It haunts me day and night. It's the only thing in all the world that I am fit for, or that's fit for me. Oh, the dreadful river!" The thought passed through my mind that in the face of my companion, as he looked upon her without speech or motion, I might have read his niece's history if I had known nothing of it. I never saw, in any painting or reality, horror and compassion so impressively blended. He shook as if he would have fallen, and his hand I touched it with my own, for his appearance alarmed me was deadly cold. "She is in a state of frenzy," I whispered to him. "She will speak differently in a little time." I don't know what he would have said in answer. He made some motion with his mouth, and seemed to think he had spoken, but he had only pointed to her with his outstretched hand. A new burst of crying came upon her now, in which she once more hid her face among the stones, and lay before us, a prostrate image of humiliation and ruin. Knowing that this state must pass, before we could speak to her with any hope, I ventured to restrain him when he would have raised her, and we stood by in silence until she became more tranquil. "Martha," said I then, leaning down, and helping her to rise. She seemed to want to rise, as if with the intention of going away, but she was weak, and leaned against a boat. "Do you know who this is, who is with me?" she said faintly, "Yes." "Do you know that we have followed you a long way tonight?" She shook her head. She looked neither at him nor at me, but stood in a humble attitude, holding her bonnet and shawl in one hand, without appearing conscious of them, and pressing the other, clenched, against her forehead. "Are you composed enough," said I, "to speak on the subject which so interested you? I hope heaven may remember it. That snowy night?" Her sobs broke out afresh, and she murmured some inarticulate thanks to me for not having driven her away from the door. "I want to say nothing for myself," she said, after a few moments. "I am bad, I am lost. I have no hope at all. But tell him, sir," she had shrunk away from him, "if you don't feel too hard to me to do it, that I never was in any way the cause of his misfortune." "It has never been attributed to you," I returned, earnestly responding to her earnestness. "It was you, if I don't deceive myself," she said, in a broken voice, "that came into the kitchen the night she took such pity on me, was so gentle to me, didn't shrink away from me like all the rest, and gave me such kind help. Was it you, sir?" "It was," said one. "I should have been in the river long ago," she said, glancing at it with a terrible expression. If any wrong tumor had been upon my mind, I never could have kept out of it a single winter's night, if I had not been free of any share in that. ... The cause of her flight is too well understood. ... I said. You are innocent of any part in it, we thoroughly believe, we know. ... I might have been much the better for her, if I had had a better heart. ... exclaimed the girl, with most forlorn regret, for she was always good to me. She never spoke a word to me, but what was pleasant and right. Is it likely I would try to make her what I am myself, knowing what I am myself, so well? When I lost everything that makes life dear, the worst of all my thoughts was that I was parted forever from her. ... Mr. Peggotty, standing with one hand on the gunwale of the boat, and his eyes cast down, put his disengaged hand before his face. And when I heard what had happened before that snowy night, from some belonging to our town, ... cried Martha, the bitterest thought in all my mind was, that the people would remember she once kept company with me, and would say I had corrupted her. When, heaven knows, I would have died to have brought back her good name. ... Long unused to any self-control, the piercing agony of her remorse and grief was terrible. To have died would not have been much, what can I say? I would have lived. ... she cried. I would have lived to be old, in the wretched streets, and to wander about, avoided, in the dark, and to see the day break on the ghastly line of houses, and remember how the same sun used to shine into my room, and wake me once. I would have done even that, to save her. ... Sinking on the stones, she took some in each hand, and clenched them up, as if she would have ground them. She writhed into some new posture constantly, stiffening her arms, twisting them before her face, as though to shut out from her eyes the little light there was, and drooping her head, as if it were heavy with insupportable recollections. What shall I ever do? ... she said, fighting thus with her despair. How can I go on as I am, a solitary curse to myself, a living disgrace to everyone I come near? ... Suddenly she turned to my companion. Stamp upon me, kill me. When she was your bride, you would have thought I had done her harm, if I had brushed against her in the street. You can't believe, why should you? A syllable that comes out of my lips. It would be a burning shame upon you, even now, if she and I exchanged a word. I don't complain. I don't say she and I are alike. I know there is a long, long way between us. I only say, with all my guilt and wretchedness upon my head, that I am grateful to her from my soul, and love her. Oh, don't think that all the power I had of loving anything is quite worn out. Throw me away, as all the world does. Kill me for being what I am, and having ever known her, but don't think that of me. ... He looked upon her, while she made this supplication, in a wild, distracted manner, and, when she was silent, gently raised her. ... said Mr. Peggotty, God forbid as I should judge you. Forbid as I, of all men, should do that, my girl. You needn't know half the change that's come, in course of time, upon me, when you think it likely. Well, ... he paused a moment, then went on. You needn't understand how tis that this here gentleman and me has wished to speak to you. You needn't understand what tis we has afore us. Listen now. ... His influence upon her was complete. She stood, shrinkingly, before him, as if she were afraid to meet his eyes. But her passionate sorrow was quite hushed and mute. If you heard, ... said Mr. Peggotty, out of what passed between Master Davy and me, th night when it snew so hard, you know as I have been weir not fur to seek my dear niece. My dear niece, ... he repeated steadily. Fur she's more dear to me now, Martha, than she was dear afore. ... She put her hands before her face, but otherwise remained quiet. I have heard her tell, ... said Mr. Peggotty, as you was early left fatherless and motherless, with no friend for to take, in a rough seafaring way, their place. Maybe you can guess that, if you'd had such a friend, you'd have got into a way of being fond of him in course of time, and that my niece was kinder daughter-like to me. Apostrophe, as she was silently trembling, he put her shawl carefully about her, taking it up from the ground for that purpose. Whereby, apostrophe said he, I know, both as she would go to the world's furthest end with me, if she could once see me again, and that she would fly to the world's furthest end, to keep off seeing me. For though she ain't no call to doubt my love, and ain't, apostrophe he repeated, with a quiet assurance of the truth of what he said, there's shame steps in, and keeps betwixt us. Apostrophe, I read, in every word of his plain impressive way of delivering himself, new evidence of his having thought of this one topic, in every feature it presented. According to our reckoning, apostrophe he proceeded, Master Davy's here, and mine, she is like, one day, to make her own poor solitary course to London. We believe Master Davy, me, and all of us, that you are as innocent of everything that has befell her, as the unborn child. You've spoke of her being pleasant, kind, and gentle to you. Bless her, I knew she was. I knew she always was, to all. You're thankful to her, and you love her. Help us all you can to find her, and may heaven reward you. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she looked at him hastily, and for the first time, as if she were doubtful of what he had said. Will you trust me? Apostrophe, apostrophe, she asked, in a low voice of astonishment. Full and free. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Peggotty. To speak to her, if I should ever find her, shelter her, if I have any shelter to divide with her, and then, without her knowledge, come to you, and bring you to her? Apostrophe, apostrophe, she asked hurriedly. We both replied together, yes. Apostrophe, apostrophe, she lifted up her eyes, and solemnly declared, that she would devote herself to this task, fervently and faithfully. That she would never waver in it, never be diverted from it, never relinquish it, while there was any chance of hope. If she were not true to it, might the object she now had in life, which bound her to something devoid of evil, in its passing away from her, leave her more forlorn and more despairing, if that were possible, than she had been upon the river's brink that night, and then might all help. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.